Today, we're going to talk about the companions on the road. Because Dorothy did not travel the road alone. She came to Oz with her little dog, Toto. Is Toto going to make an appearance? We'll find out, right? We know the character of Glinda watched along the way as she traveled. And as she was traveling the road, she comes across three friends. She meets the not-so-smart Scarecrow and the heartless Tin Man and the, we call him, Cowardly Lion. And they meet and they talk and these three decide, I'll journey with you to see the wizard. And well, while they were there, I just want you to understand, they became friends along the way. But they didn't join Dorothy to get her home. They all wanted something, didn't they? They walked the path because of things that were missing in their life. The Scarecrow, he wanted a brain. If I only had a brain, right? The Tin Man, he wanted a heart. He wanted to feel and have emotions. And the Lion, he was hoping for a little courage. Interesting enough, the things they wanted were much like Dorothy's desire to go home. They already had what they needed. They just had to learn how to use it. I mean, when they got to the wizard eventually, did the wizard ever give the Scarecrow a brain? No, he gave him a piece of rolled up paper with a little tassel on it to let him know that you already were smart enough. Did he give the Tin Man a heart? No, he gave him a watch that he wore on the outside to symbolize the heart. And did he give the Lion courage? No, he gave him a medal for the courage he had already been showing. And I just can't help but wonder, is this with our journey of suffering? Have we already gotten the things that we need to journey the road of suffering? We just have to learn how to use it, right? So today, we're going to change our focus a little bit. We've been talking about Job's journey of suffering and how that kind of relates to our journey with suffering. But today, we're going to focus more on how do you help somebody else that is journeying with suffering? You come across somebody else and their life is falling apart and God just lays it on your heart. I need to do something to help this person. And that's where we're going to be today. So if you want to follow along, I'm going to be in Job chapter 2. And we're going to start off with our journey of suffering. And we're going to go with Job chapter 2, verses 11 through 13. When Job's three friends, yes, Job had three friends. Dorothy had three friends. What a perfect connection, right? When Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhanite, and Zophar the Naamahite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, so they didn't even get close enough to really get into this, from a distance, they're looking away, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep out loud, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads, and then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights, and no one said a word because they saw how great his suffering. So, again, Job has these wonderful three friends that are going to come and see him during his time of suffering. And they had a goal. They're going to comfort him. They're going to make him feel better about the things that he's experiencing. Okay, that sounds like a really good idea. And I just want to tell you, when they got there, they absolutely, positively did everything right. Did you see the list? It says they began to cry. So they saw Job's suffering, and it moved them emotionally, and they began, it said weep, which means they were uncontrollably crying about what they were seeing. It says they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. And this is an act of mourning. And if you remember, this is similar to what Job did at the beginning in chapter 1, verse 20. It said, at this, Job got up and tore his robes and shaved his head and fell to the ground in worship. So literally, his three friends joined Job in his suffering. They didn't just come and look and say, man, this is terrible. This is awful. We should do something. Their immediate reaction was to do what Job did and just kind of come and join him. And they stayed with him during his suffering. They didn't just come for a visit and a quick handshake and to say, sorry for your loss. They got into Job's suffering and they sat there for 7 days and 7 nights. I have no idea who fed these men, because it sure won't Mrs. Job. Okay? So they sat there for 7 days and 7 nights with their friend because of his suffering. And here's the amazing thing. They remained silent. They didn't show up and start offering advice. They didn't show up and try to, you know, put on a show or a happy face and tell Job, cheer up, it's going to get better. They just sat there. And you might say, well, why is that important? Because the first lesson that we have to understand is nobody wants to be alone in suffering. Nobody wants to face the things on this road all by themselves. You aren't designed to be alone. God said it. It's not good for man to be alone. And so these friends had a great idea. And after 7 days of this, well, they began to reap some dividends from all of their efforts. So if we're in chapter 2, you can turn the page now, because I'm headed into chapter 3. And Job finally speaks. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. So what we're going to see from Job is going to be a pretty self-loathing speech. He has a serious case of the woe is me's. Him and George Bailey probably could have had a really good convention at this point, because he's questioning his existence. But think about it. After all he's been through, what else would you expect? I mean, sometimes I can get a splinter in my finger and oh, woe is me. I have a splinter in my finger. It hurts so much. I can watch my 401k drop a little bit. Oh, woe is me. What am I going to do? Financial distress. Remember, this guy had lost everything. Kids, his wife was having issues. His wealth was all gone. Everything is gone. What would you expect him to be like? Funny how often we pass really quick judgment when we see people in suffering. We forget. They're suffering, folks. And as he begins to speak, Job asks 5 questions. First question, why did I not perish at birth and die as I came out of the womb? You know what he's saying, right? Why on earth did God allow me to survive childbirth? He's just going to put me through this. He should have just done away with me at the beginning, right? Why were there knees to receive me and a breast that I might be nursed? Mom, you should have just let me die. If I'd have known all of this, who wants you to take care of me and raise me and tend me? Why was I not hidden away in the ground like a stillborn child? Like an infant who never really saw the light of day? this isn't very happy, right? Job's not happy. Who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave? That's an interesting question. Who on earth is happy on the day they get to the graveside? And well, why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? Now, is Job depressed? Probably. But I do want you to see, he's not pondering suicide. He's doing something very natural. It's called grieving. And so Job is processing. And as I am watching this, Job starts to ask these questions, and all of them have kind of a redundance to them. He wants to know why and who. Okay? And in those questions, if you remember real quick as I put them on the screen, how many of them actually involve God? Only the last one. He doesn't understand where the happy days went. Things were so much better in the good old days, and now my life is falling apart. And now what do I do? And I have to tell you something. My mind is flat out screaming at Job's friends. Don't take the bait. Stay the course. Don't do it. Drat. They did it anyway. Job's friends attempt to try to answer Job's questions. And it all starts to fall apart. Because they have decided to go from comforting, they are going to try to make sense of Job's suffering. Yeah, good luck with that one. Do you really think you stand a chance? And over the next 24 chapters, so now you can feel very thankful I'm not reading all of today's verses to you. Over the next 24 chapters, they start a back and forth discussion between Job and themselves, and back and forth it goes. And as the conversation goes, the longer it goes, Job gets accused. I'm sure that was helpful, right? And his friends become self-righteous and judgmental. And, oh my gosh, you got to be kidding me. They actually start arguing. You ever been there? You showed up in somebody's life who is going through some hard times, and you sat with them for a little bit, and you listened to them grieve, and then, unfortunately, the humanity inside of them is like, I could explain this to you if you just let me. And I pull out my Bible and I go to Romans chapter 8. All things work together for those who love God. And yeah, that's how this. You're not there, folks. You don't understand. Because Job looked at his friends who had spent a week with him and declared they went from being profitable comforters to miserable comforters. Job chapter 16, so I've jumped a long way if you're trying to keep up today. Job chapter 16, verses 1 through 5. Then Job replied, I have heard many things like these. You are miserable comforters, all of you. Will your long-winded speeches never end? What ails you that you keep on arguing? I could speak like you if you were in my place. I could make fine speeches against you and shake my head at you, but my mouth would encourage you. Comfort from my lips would bring you relief. Job saw right through what they were doing. We went from being profitable, we're helping Job grieve, to being miserable. We've now added to Job's suffering. And as Job begins to speak again, he asks some more questions. But I want you to notice the difference in the tone of these questions. For what hope have the godless when they are cut off, when God takes away their life? Does God listen to their cry when distress is upon them? Will they find daylight in the Almighty? Will they call on God at all times? Why then this meaningless talk? I can almost see the little head. I am Oz. You realize that's what Job is now seeing. Matter of fact, to Job's miserable, comforting friends, I'd like to say, well done, boys. You took him from seeking understanding to now he's accusing God. You get back with those questions. Whose fault is my suffering? Who does Job think it is now? It's God. And perhaps you're wondering, what is the difference between what his friends were doing and what our witch that never was, Mrs. Job, was doing? And I have to remind you something here. Mrs. Job, when she approached her husband, was not trying to comfort him at all. She was trying to process. And Mrs. Job was in the suffering with her husband, not an external party. So her conversation should look much different than those that have come. So the question is, so we read the how they started and we read Job's response. How does one go from being a profitable comforter to being a miserable comforter? And the good news is I think Dorothy's friends and what Dorothy's friends were lacking and what they went looking for at the wizard will speak volumes to what we see when we actually begin to look at how his three friends approached his comforting from his suffering. So let's start with the scarecrow, because they certainly lack some understanding about suffering. I'm in Job chapter 4, verses 7 through 9. Consider now who is being innocent, has ever perished. Where were the upright ever destroyed? As I have observed, this is his first friend, those who plow evil are those who sow trouble and reap it. At the birth of God, they perish and blast his anger, and the blast of his anger, they are no more. That sounds helpful, doesn't it? The first thing that you need to know is all three men start off with a premise that suffering only comes to those who deserve to suffer. And if you really want to step back and take a really, really wide angle view, that I could make a case for it. Because suffering comes from sin, and we've all sinned, and so I guess in a roundabout way, we all suffer, right? However, their argument takes the point of assuming that suffering is caused by a sinful action by the individual. So they're not looking at sin as a whole. They're looking at Job and saying, Job, there is something you have done that has made God mad. There is something that you have done that has put you in this situation. Job, you have no one to blame but yourself. And this isn't an uncommon argument. John chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, the disciples struggled with this. As they went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? So this isn't uncommon. And don't think that we are immune to it, because when we go and we start talking to people and they're really, well, what did you do? What? You must have done something. You mean, God just doesn't put people here unless you did something. But I need to remind you of something. These three guys are missing an important piece of information. You know what they're missing? Scene one, act one. These guys didn't get the behind the view of the scene that we're getting when we know this has nothing to do with Job's sin. This has to do with something going on behind the scenes. But the real problem with this idea that we go and that we assume that you're suffering because of sin, statement, am I dying here? I'm not. There you go. The statement is arrogant. Because you understand what they're really saying? What they're really saying is, my sin is okay because all I did was steal a pen. My sin is okay because I'm not suffering. Your sin is bad because you are. What an arrogant statement to make. To think God is okay with some sin but not all sin? James tells us guilty of one, guilty of all of them. Sin is sin. And the idea immediately puts Job, who is already going through suffering and trying to grieve, he is now on the defensive. He's building up his, okay, I'm going to fix this real quick. I've got something popping. I think if I just do this, that will fix it, I hope. So he's now on the defensive. All because these three guys, they lack understanding, but that's not all they lack. Nope. We come to this guy, and we meet the tin man, and what was he lacking? Compassion for the suffering. Job chapter 8, verses 1 through 4. Then Bildad the Shuhite replied, "How long will you say such things? Your words are a blustering wind. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert what is right? When your children sinned against him, he gave them over to the penalty of their sin." So I just want to let you know something. I am positive Job is a better man than me. Because at this point, I would have decked this man. I'm not kidding you. It would have been more than I could have taken. Because you get what he is saying. Job, your children are dead because they sinned. End of story. Can you imagine that? Like I said, I would have punched this guy probably right in the mouth. I can't believe he would do this. Of course, since their death was due to their sin, well, we have to go back to the front of the story. Remember, Job had something that he was trying to help them with their sin. Job chapter 1, verses 4 through 5, his sons used to hold feasts in their homes and on their birthdays, and they would invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. And by the way, they weren't drinking soda pop and water, just so you know. Eat and drink with them. And when the period of feasting had run its course, Job made arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. So Job cared about his kids. And now here's this man. Look at him saying, "But the reason they're dead, Job, is because of their sin." And by the way, Job, if you were a better parent, then guess what? They wouldn't be dead. That's what he tells Job. Talk about heartless. This man just lost 10 kids. How is that going to help Job? But you understand, when you're trying to make suffering a sense of suffering, somebody's got to be to blame, right? And this would make Job 0 for 10 when it came to being a parent, right? Job, you should never decide, you should have no more kids in your life because you just don't understand this parenting thing. So get the picture. Here's the man. Kids are dead. Wealth is gone. I'm sitting in a pile of ashes with sores all over my body. I've shaved my head. I want to make sense of it. And here's my friend telling me my kids are dead and it's all my fault. How many of you think that would make you feel better about any of this? Yeah. That's miserable company, folks. And then we get to the lion. And the lion, well, he lacked the courage to face suffering. Job chapter 11, verses 13 through 18. Yet if you devote your heart, Job, if you'll devote your heart to him and stretch out your hands to him, if you will put away the sin that is in your hands and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, then free of fault, you will lift up your face. You will stand firm, and without fear, you will surely forget your trouble. Recalling it is only as darkness will become like the morning. Excuse me. Recalling it only as the waters go by. Life will be brighter than noonday, and darkness will become like morning. He will be secure because there is hope. You will look about and you will take rest in your safety. Job, my friend, if you were just brave enough to admit your sin, then your suffering would end. You think? Yeah, this guy doesn't understand anything. He's missing the idea, because he tells him, you're going to forget all about this someday, Job. You're going to look back on this and laugh at it. 10 kids dead. Is he ever going to look back and say, you know, thank you, Lord, for letting me go through that? It's not going to happen. He's not going to forget. And Job, if you would just have a little more courage and you'd be a little braver in the way you're approaching things, then you understand you will have hope and rest and safety. Really? You think Job sees a lot of hope? Not from where he's sitting right now. You think Job is having any restful night's sleep at this point? Not going to happen. He just had everything stolen from him. Do you think he feels very safe? I mean, this is a guy that's wondering, where did God go? See, here's the reality of our three friends. They are not trying to face suffering. They're trying to fix it. Yep. And you understand why they're trying to fix it, right? Because the last thing they want to do is journey with it. If we can figure out why you're suffering, Job, then not only can we fix your problem, then I know, don't do that, because I'm not going down the same path. They've taken their comforting from looking out after Job to looking out after me. Because I don't want to suffer. And all of it has much to do with one simple word that we saw all the way back in chapter 3, verse 11. And I read all that through, and this word probably flew right by you. When they originally went to go and see Job, they were going to sympathize with him. And sympathy, by definition of a dictionary, and an affinity, association, or relationship between persons or things wherein whatever affects one similarly affects the other. Do you really think they could be affected by what happened to Job and the way it affected Job? Think about that for a second. If you're going to minister to somebody that has lost a child, there is no way on earth you can understand what they're going through unless you have lost a child. It can't be done. If you're going to minister to somebody that is a widower that has just lost their spouse, yes, I can have sympathy for them, but I really can't understand it because I have never been in your shoes. Now, I'm going to give them some credit. Job's friends cared about Job. And they were initially sincere in what they were doing. But when it comes to comforting those that are in suffering, here's what you need to know. Sympathy is not bad, but sympathy can only take you so far. Sympathy can only take you there as long as it lasts and you want to be a shoulder to cry on. Sympathy is why houses go quiet after funerals, as people who are very sympathetic for your loss go back to their life. And you're left there to figure it out. Sometimes sympathy is all you have. But no, it's not a place, it's a place to comfort from. But you're going to have difficulty caring for their suffering needs. I can feel sorry for you. I think I've got a short right there. I can feel sorry for you. It can rip my heart out. I can see you and weep and cry for you, but you understand eventually there's only so much of that I can do because this isn't my life. And so sympathy has a stopping point. And as you're looking at the heading on that slide, you can see there's a second word, because if you really want to be profitable comforters, you have to take a step beyond just sympathizing with them. You have to show a little empathy. Empathy is the action of understanding, being aware of, being sensitive to, and vicariously experiencing the feelings, thoughts of the experience, an experience of another. And I love this. If you take nothing else out of this sermon today, take this. Sympathy is an emotion. I feel it. Empathy is an action. You get it? I can feel sorry for you, and it can even bring me to an emotional state, but I eventually, if I'm going to really care about you, I got to put some action behind those emotions. It requires, did you see it? Awareness, sensitivity, which these guys really need some sensitivity training. They didn't get sensitivity at all. You seek to understand, but not explain. And absolutely, positively, definitely, don't try to fix it. You're there, you're listening, you're thinking about it, and they just did not get it. You see, his friends, they had some issues, because Jesus, well, he understood empathy. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15 says, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are, yet did not sin." God did not feel sorry for us. I greatly appreciated Rich's communion meditation this morning. We were talking about this before worship service, and he told me, I'm like, oh my gosh, you're right down the middle of the sermon. And him and I hadn't talked this week about what we're doing. He's right there because he just didn't feel sorry that I had been judged. He decided to step down and do something about it. So let's talk about Job's friends, and more importantly, maybe about ourselves. Because if Job's friends had empathy, the goal would not have been just to merely comfort Job. They would have sought to care for him. Think about this for a second. Their actions could have been many, and their words could have been few. Or maybe they should have been few. 24 chapters of back and forth argument berating Job. In those 24 chapters, Job had a lot of needs. Did anybody else see them offer or clean those sores? Ew, that's disgusting. That's what Job needed. As a matter of fact, it says he was scraping the pus with a piece of pottery. That's what he needed. Well, I don't know. That requires a little bit more. Job's finances were a mess. Did they come with assistance or even a meal? Sat there for 7 days. Maybe Job wasn't ready to eat, and that's okay. But all they came there with were their broken hearts and a lot of empty words. And when we get to the end of the story, God is going to have some very choice words for these three. But that's a sermon for another day. We need to understand that in our journey with suffering, we are going to run across others that are suffering. And just like Jesus stepped out of heaven and into their life to make a difference, We are called to do more than comfort them. We are called to care for them. How much are we supposed to care for them? How much did Jesus care for them? Wait a minute, he traded his life for their life.
Yeah.
You get it? That's profitable comforting. It's going to give you the opportunity to not just share Jesus through words, but show Jesus through your actions. Interesting enough, in Matthew chapter 25, Jesus tells a story about sheep and goats. He decides who is and who isn't. And it had nothing to do with coming forward or doing this or doing that. You realize what he said, right? You know the story. When I was sick, did you come see me? When I was in jail, did you come visit? When I was naked, did you give me some clothes? When I was hungry, did you give me some food? And the ones that said, yeah, we did that. Well, we did it to somebody, but not to you. Jesus said, that's okay, you got the point. For when you minister to the least of those, you're doing it for me. And then he turned to the goats and said, so what about you guys? And the goats like, man, we didn't even see it. He's like, yeah. That's why you're miserable comforters and you've earned your judgment. That's going to be a harsh day for a lot of people. They think that some religious activity did the good thing for them. And Jesus says, that's not what it's supposed to be about. It's supposed to be a righteous life through a relationship with him. And in that, we will always be profitable comforters.